duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
How's it going, Higherside Chatters? Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke from San Diego. I'm Greg Carlwood, and today we're going to go deeper than deep with Jay Widener, scholar of Gnostic texts and alchemical traditions, maker of films such as Kubrick's Odyssey and Time Wave 2013, and exposer of the ugly truth about the crypto-terrestrials, aka the Archons, aka the global elite, in their final form. But also back in the saddle today is my occasional co-pilot, Adam Gorightly, hot on the heels of a psychedelic symphony of high weirdness at the first annual ParanoiaCon and our first real-world meet and greet. Always a pleasure to have him along for the ride. Adam, man, how you holding up?
Good, dude. Man, you got a lot of energy this morning. I'm just having my second cup of coffee here.
Yeah, man, it's tough, but, you know, that's it helps the show go along. I mean, you know, it was great to see you in San Diego, man. A lot of other bona fide pimps were there. Did you have a pretty good time?
Yeah, it was a blast. I enjoyed it there at, what was that place? Cafe Saboka or Baka, however you say that little Russian restaurant. Really liked the scene there. It was fun, kind of a small, intimate venue, but yeah, got to interact with some of the other conspiracy type researchers and people there at the event. So it was fun.
Yeah, man, your set was pretty great. It was nice to have a rockadelic interlude to a series of two-hour talks. I mean, as fascinating as they were, you know, it was good to jazz it up a little bit.
Good, yeah, it helps break it up a bit. And, yeah, I had a fun time playing the set with my buddy Joe, so it was cool.
He was a cool guy, too. And while we're hitting on Thane's paranoia, you have a pretty awesome article in the new issue of Paranoia Magazine. Covers two of my favorite subjects, conspiracy and comedians, and it's titled appropriately, The Dead Comedian Conspiracy. It's something rarely talked about, but it's how I got into conspiracy topics from the work of Bill Hicks and George Carlin, and it's funny because you hear about government agencies keeping a close eye on various musicians and musical acts in the 60s and 70s, but never comedians who are just as capable of rattling cages and being just as influential, which is a real problem for the establishment, you know?
Yeah, the deeper I looked into it, you know, the more it seemed curious, all the deaths of these different comedians who were... In a sense, you know, comedians are philosophers or social activists. They're the fly in the ointment. And starting, you know, with Lenny Bruce, his death was curious, and he was definitely a target of the government and the fuzz back in the day. And then you look at other people like Freddie Prinze. He was into a lot of political stuff, on and on. You know, they all fit the profile. You mentioned Bill Hicks and... The list goes on. There's many more that seem to die at curiously at curious times in their careers, right as they were getting ready to be catapulted to greater stardom and have a wider audience.
Yeah, another interesting part of that article I thought was that this guy, this certain coroner, he had been the man to perform a bunch of suspicious and high-profile autopsies back in the day. I think Marilyn Monroe, Robert Kennedy, and where it comes into your article is John Belushi, whose death I always thought was a pretty cut-and-dried drug overdose, but it originally was reported as natural causes, which is pretty highly suspicious, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Thomas Noguchi you're talking about, who was the coroner in L.A. for... Holy smokes, something like 30 years. He handled all those high-profile autopsies that you mentioned there, that all of them that seemed, or people suggest, have conspiracies swirling around them. Noguchi was modeled after the character in the television show with Jack Klugman. Jack Klugman is the coroner. What the hell was that called? That was way before your time.
Yeah, man, I'm lost.
Yeah, I had a little brain fart there, but people know who I'm talking about, who go back to those days. But yeah, the it'll come to me in a minute. But yeah, the Belushi one was real curious. I first heard about from another comedian, social activist, Dick Gregory, who's been knee-deep into all this conspiracy stuff for years and years. And he claimed that Belushi, around the time of his death, was looking at into some other mysterious Hollywood deaths, in particular Natalie Wood and William Holden. And Gregory suggests that Belushi had information that William Holden was friends with Ronald Reagan. In fact, he was the best man at Reagan's wedding. This was during the Reagan administration.
Damn.
Holden had information about the Reagan White House that he shared with Natalie Wood, Robert Wagner, and that bunch. Robert Wagner was in a show called Heart to Heart with Stephanie Powers, and Stephanie Powers was William Holden's main squeeze. So all these people were connecting. Of course, Natalie Wood died of a pretty suspicious death, which it's been revived in the news recently as well. I guess Gregory claimed that hey, I got a cat here. I got to kick out of the room. It starts doing the
dude,
crazy
I got the
stuff.
Same thing.
Hang on just a sec. Damn, they're worse than kids. But and so, yeah, Dick Gregory contended that Belushi's supposed accidental overdose was much more than that.
Yeah, wasn't he supposed to meet just the night before he died?
Yeah, that's Dick Gregory said that he Belushi had planned a meeting with Gregory's buddy Mark Lane. Mark Lane was the first guy to write a book critical of the Warren Report back in it was the mid 60s, one of the first book, and he's been very active JFK assassination researcher, conspiracy researcher. And Belushi apparently had some information on the JFK assassination, or the RFK, I forget which one, and he was supposed to meet with Mark Lane the next day. And then once again, he had that apparent overdose at the Chateau Marmont in L.A., which effectively perhaps silenced him.
Yeah, man, it's wild. I mean, things I always thought were cut and dry are pretty crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, and it was Bill Hicks who really did get me into conspiracy. I was a huge, huge fan of his, and also into psychedelics, you know, because he started talking about his use in psychedelics is kind of what brought him to these notions. And I was like, yeah, I'm down. Let's go down that rabbit hole. But have you ever seen this conspiracy that Bill Hicks is actually Alex Jones?
Yeah, it's a bunch of nonsense.
I know, it really is. It really is. But it's
the thing that offends me a little bit. But he's, you know, sounds a bit like Bill.
Yeah.
Intonations and whatnot, but he certainly doesn't have the subtlety, yeah, or
right.
sense of humor that Bill Hicks had. So yeah. You know, Bill Hicks is near and dear to my heart because he had that psychedelic experience on shrooms with his buddy Kevin Booth and some others, where they made contact with something or other. And I had a similar thing when I was growing up that made me question consensus reality, a psychedelic visitation with a friend of mine with the other, whatever that was, who knows.
Yeah, I mean, he's a sacred cow in my mind. It would kill me. I know that's a big part of the thing, is they may look somewhat similar, but he wouldn't become a shill like that, or what I would say, Alex Jones. I mean, I'm not a huge Alex Jones fan. I think he's just a fear monger, and he keeps people waiting. He's like a fear porn guy, you know?
Mm-hmm. And he's, well, he comes from family money, and he's making bank off his empire. And
right.
Seems a bit hypocritical. If you pull up, I don't know if you can find him anymore on the web, but he owns this huge mansion out in Texas somewhere. I mean, a huge mansion that it's like Citizen Kane, Citizen Hearst type of mansion.
Really?
Yeah.
Damn, I'm gonna have to look into that. Yeah, he definitely doesn't seem like his heart's in the right place there.
Hey, I got on the web here the television program. After Noguchi was Quincy.
Quincy.
Yeah, Jack Klugman was in that. I don't know. Before your time, I guess.
Right on, yeah. I mean, I watched a lot of shows from that era that were on Nick at Night, because I watched a lot of that growing up, but Quincy didn't make it on there.
Yeah, a lot of those shows, it was kind of lame, but based after the coroner, Thomas Noguchi.
Right on. Well, before we bring Jay in, I did want to ask you on the air how your book projects were coming along.
Oh, they're coming along. Nothing to speak of yet. You know, I hate getting into them too deep until they actually get published. The one that we'll see first out of these ones I'm working on is The History of Discordianism, and it's being laid out right now and working with the publisher. It's pretty complex project because there's a lot of materials, letters and illustrations and different thing these guys wrote who were involved in that scene back in the day. So it's getting things all put together and captions, and so it's moving along. Hopefully we'll see it published later this year. And also working on a website for all these different related projects, which will be historiadiscordia.com, but it's not really active yet. That's being put together, and I think if you go there now, it'll just bring up a page that says Finord. But things are coming.
Good stuff, man. I'm glad you're able to stay motivated. I'm trying to get a book done, but I like weed and Gordon Ramsay shows too much. It's sort of ironic. Mentally, it's motivating, but in three-dimensional reality, I'm just sitting there for hours on the couch not doing shit.
Yeah.
It's a strange form of self-torture. But all right, it's about that time that we steer this ship deep into the depths of conspiracy and examine as much of the ocean of information as we can with Jay Widener. But first, I'm going to pound your ears with the beat of my conspiracy clothing brand, Conspiraties, in an ad we've all heard 1,000 times, but maybe 1,001 is going to be the great motivator for you. And then I can eat again this week. So here goes, and Adam and I will be talking with the legendary Jay Widener on the other side.
We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the Brave Roof tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiraties as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dress or frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiraties redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiraties.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft talk.
All right, we are back, people, and we know there are many layers to the conspiracy onion, many branches on the conspiracy tree, and I like to dive as deep into these weird waters as a guest will allow, and today's going to be a real treat, because Jay Widener is not afraid to throw off the floaties and take us to the bottom of the conspiratorial sea. He's a real authority on hermetic and alchemical traditions, hidden symbolism in both the ancient world and their more modern uses, and he's a true scholar of the Gnostic texts. He's written for years on these topics and produced numerous films, the one that put him on my radar being Kubrick's Odyssey, Secrets Hidden in the Films of Stanley Kubrick, which details Jay's position that the elite commissioned Kubrick to fake the moon landing footage, and it makes a pretty compelling case, I must say. He's a conspiratorial jack of all trades and master of enlightening media. Jay, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, no problem. Glad to be here.
You know, a lot of times I find that a person puts out something interesting like Kubrick's Odyssey, and I think, man, I really want to have them on the show to talk about that. And then I start looking into their work, and I find that it goes much deeper. And sometimes it doesn't. But in your case, Kubrick's Odyssey is really just a drop in the bucket compared to the more paradigm-changing information that you're privy to and the things that you share about the true nature of the elites, their core goal, which is not only their thinly veiled matrix of global enslavement, but also the suppression of true human potential, as well as some really interesting exposure on certain secrets within our solar system. I hope we can cover a good amount of it in just a short hour, man, which is challenging in itself. But since we're new to Jay Widener here on THC, and I have a good idea of what's coming down the pike myself, I'm curious as to how you came to uncover some of the hidden knowledge that you have. So I got to ask you, how did you get clued in on what's really going on out there?
Well, it's a good question. It actually, I guess it started a long time ago, in 1986, when I had a profound shamanic experience in which all of my personal paradigms were blasted away and shattered in an overnight experience. And then that made me realize that I was pretty much wrong about everything that I had held true to that point in my life. I was still a young man, and I had to discard everything that I had been taught. And then I discovered a book in a book sale called Mysteries of the Cathedrals by a man named Fulcanelli in the same year. And I took the book home and I tried to read it. I thought it was a book about architecture and the Gothic cathedrals, that is. And I took the book home and I realized that actually the book was about an arcane subject called alchemy. And me, being a practical, scientific kind of guy, knew that there could never be anything real like alchemy. So I set out to debunk this very, very clever, intellectually driven book, and the book debunked me. And pretty soon I began realizing that science was pretty much wrong, history was a lie, and everywhere I went as I investigated this book, to refute it, I instead found out that the book by Fulcanelli was right, and that almost everything I had been taught in school and college and everything I had read was wrong. Wrong, not just wrong, but devised wrong. In other words, it was done on purpose. It was wrong, but it was wrong on purpose. Yeah. And that one took me about 20 years to really get my head around why anyone would write down false stories and false histories. And, of course, that led me down into the rabbit hole of a million other things. And so I made an agreement with myself in 1990 that if in 20 years I could look back and say, no, I'm probably not right about those conspiracies I was looking at all those times ago, then I would just drop it and go live a normal life. But if in 20 years I look back and I said, no, it's even worse than I thought, then I will go full bore into it and devote my life to it. And so in 2006, on the 20th anniversary of my awakening, I had a long talk with myself, and I said, okay, do I believe it more or do I believe it less? And the answer was resounding. I not only believe it more, I know it's true. And so then I've gone from, since 2006, last 7 years, pretty much confident that I know what I'm saying is right and going forth. I knew that Kubrick had done the moon landings way before 2006. I knew in 2001 that he had done it, but I didn't have the confidence until after my 20-year review for me to go forward and say that he had done it and then prove it. So a lot of things solidified, and I'm kind of actually happy to say that the world seems to be slowly coming towards the point of view, my point of view, or our point of view, or the awakened point of view, and I actually sort of almost smell victory in the air. So I don't know what to say besides that. You know, the world is far more intricate and far more conspiratorial than anyone can possibly imagine.
Man, I agree with you, but let's talk Kubrick for a couple minutes. I mean, I always thought there was something cryptic about the man and his films. I mean, Eyes Wide Shut is known to be soaked in symbolism and is a not so subtle expose on the pastimes of the elite. And I know Adam's written a bit about him as well, but Jay, tell us about Kubrick and his symbolism and his connections that put him in such a position to make a film like Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah, I mean, when I first had my revelation about Mr. Kubrick was about 3 weeks after he died in 1999. It was, I think it was April 1999 when I started getting my first, I guess you could say, revelatory knowledge about what he was putting into his film. And I wrote an article called Alchemical Kubrick in April of 1999. And it went out and literally had millions and millions of hits. It was really the first article I'd ever written that got millions of hits and caused a huge amount of controversy. And a lot of people wrote to me, you know, May, June of 1999, going, "You're crazy. You're reading too much into 2001: A Space Odyssey. You don't know what you're talking about. Kubrick wasn't into the occult. Kubrick wasn't into the elites. You don't know what you're talking about." And I had to admit to myself that my critics were actually right. I really had no evidence in any of his films that he was into the occult, outside of The Shining, maybe. Right. And then on July 16th, 1999, just a few months after I wrote my first article, Eyes Wide Shut came out. And damn, there it was. And it was like, bam, whoa. You know, he, not only is he into the occult, he's into revealing what the occult, what the elites are doing in their occult rituals. And then I thought to myself, well, why would he do that? And then my answer came back, because maybe possibly he attended some of these orgies, some of these rituals. And then I thought, well, okay, it does seem the movie itself is very autobiographical, Eyes Wide Shut, in that he made the set designer design Tom and Nicole Cruise's apartment to look just like his apartment in the late 50s in the village there in New York. And so there were all these parallels that I was noticing. So then that caused me to take an even greater look at Stanley. And so in 2001, in celebration of his great film 2001, they released the DVD of the movie 2001. I bought it, I took it home, and within the first 20 minutes of watching the movie, I not only realized that he'd faked the moon landings, but how he had done it, and front screen projection, among other things. And then I sat on it for the next 10 years, actually, until 2009 when I finally went public with my findings. That's how I got, and what it was Kubrick was kind of the end of a full cycle, a cycle that began with Folcanelli in 1986, and me having my previous world completely and utterly destroyed, and having to find my balance, losing my wife, losing my family, losing my friends, and everyone just abandoning me because they thought I'd lost my mind, to finally coming to grips with not only the conspiracy, but that the conspiracy uses people like Stanley Kubrick, and then how does it use it? And I began to figure all that out, and I think that was a real shot across the bow. And I believe it was all planned by Kubrick. He put the stuff in his films. I think he thought it would take a little bit longer for someone to figure it out and find it and bring it out. I think he was really surprised if he'd been alive that it happened so soon, within 10 years after his death. But it is, and I'm not alone. And like you said, Adam Gilwrightly's writing about him, and there's about 100 other people that are combing through his films with a fine-tooth comb, and we're finding out all the secrets that he lay buried in there, secrets that he wanted to be found out, secrets that he wanted revealed through pop culture so they could never be taken back. It's actually quite brilliant, and for a man with a 200 IQ like Stanley, job well done, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, Jay, do you think that he crossed the line with Eyes Wide Shut and was did away with because of that?
Well, you know, I can't say because I wasn't there. And he was still smoking cigarettes at 70 years old.
Yeah.
and I know that shooting a movie, because I'm just finishing one, is a serious physical, can really break you down. I'm much younger than he was, and it just about tore me into the ground. So I don't know. I do know this, the fact that he died 666 days before January 1st, 2001, really brings a lot of red flags and alarm bells in my head. And I also talked to, I don't know who this man was, he called me anonymously, and told me that Kubrick was in the lobby while the Warner Brothers executives were watching the cut of Eyes Wide Shut, and Kubrick was walking back and forth in the lobby muttering to himself, they're going to kill me. They're going to see this film and they're going to get so pissed off they're going to kill me. And I don't know if he meant that figuratively or real, but 5 days later he was dead.
Wow. What? Yeah, I've seen the film you put together exposing, you know, the 2001 and the moon landing using this front screen projection method. And indeed, I found that pretty damn compelling.
Well, it is. And what's amazing about it is that there's all these people that are trying to debunk that those findings. And what's funny is their debunking is just so pathetic. Like, one guy's a NASA expert. He's trying to rip me apart. And he says, well, you know, Widener finds all these geometries up in the sky, you know, above the moon. And then what he does is he pulls out another photograph of, I think it was Apollo 11 launching. And he says, but see, I found the same thing here. And so here we have the sky of Florida, you know, as the launch is going up. And there are indeed some strange articulations up in the sky. But dude, I'm talking about on the moon. I'm not talking about a photograph taken from the Earth of the Apollo launching. I'm talking about on the moon, and it's not just one photograph. It's literally hundreds and hundreds of photographs. If you want to tell me that that is not proof of front screen projection, great. What is it then? But nothing. Because when you argue with imbeciles, or when you debate with imbeciles, you got to be careful and not look like an imbecile yourself. Because, as Mark Twain said, never get in an argument with a fool, because anyone watching will have trouble finding out, discovering who's who. And so I don't really go after my debunkers anymore. I use shows like this to debunk them. But actually, I hate to say this, but I haven't met one who seems to have a high enough IQ to even bother with arguing with.
Oh, snap. But to clarify, you do think we went to the moon, you just think the footage was faked, right?
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much know that beyond any shadow of a doubt that we've had a secret space program since we brought the Nazis into the United States in the 50s. And the Nazis, if you know Joseph Farrell's work, the Nazis weren't working on they were working on standard rocket technology, but they were working on extremely exotic anti-gravitational vehicles. And we scooped them all up. I don't believe there was ever a Cold War. I believe that there's a third party on top of both the Soviet Union and the U.S., and that they parceled out the research so that the United States did one part of the research and the Soviet Union did another part of the research. And then they put them in competition against each other so that there would be faster turnarounds. And almost as if they were in an emergency and they were working really fast to develop this technology. And I believe that the red mercury that they discovered, that the Nazis discovered, was perfected, I know it was, by both the Soviet Union and the United States, and that this is the source of the anti-gravity machines. I'm not saying there's not aliens. I'm not saying anything like that. I'm just saying that we have a lot of equipment that they don't want anyone to know about. In fact, this is the ultimate conspiracy, and they don't want anyone to find out about it. And this technology is so astonishing, because it's all derived from Tesla and the German scientists, that literally we would never have an energy shortage. We would never have a Fukushima. It's a crime. It is criminal what these guys are doing with this technology. And we've got to find a way to get it released.
Well said, man. And that is quite the challenge. But I want to talk to you about they, who they are, the sinister, ominous they that we hear about. And this might be where the Archons come in. Because, you know, a lot of people take this train up into the point where we're talking about Bilderbergs, the Vatican, the world's banking elite, even a secret space program. But this is where they get off, when we talk about a non-human entity at the top of the pyramid. But I think the situation is more than a few rich white guys who got lucky printing money. There's something strange going on. And this seems to be the area you talk about with the Archons. So what is going on here, man? What's the deal?
Well, I mean, we're not really sure, you know, what the Gnostics said in the Nag Hammadi about the Archons is that they were an off-planet spiritual parasite that would get into human beings and change the way that they acted. And the way that they acted after this invasion was a non-human way. So what is a non-human way? Well, they described it as, you know, non-empathic. So they can't feel people's feelings. The inability to walk in another guy's shoes. The inability to think about anybody other than yourself. And the Greek translation of the word archon just merely means rulers. So what I think now is that the Earth may or may not have been invaded by off-planet spiritual parasites. I don't know. But we know that there is a mental disorder called psychopathic behavior. And it mimics exactly what the Gnostics used to describe the Archons.
Sure.
Lack of empathy, inability to see into somebody else, the way somebody else thinks, manipulative, cunning, you know, all the things that they use are exactly what we today use as terms to describe people with psychopathic behavior. So I merely say, okay, if you don't want to make that leap into the off-planet spiritual parasites, I totally understand it because it is a rather wacky concept. But you cannot deny that there is 1-4% of the human population that is completely psychopathically driven, and that these psychopaths are in positions of power, i.e. rulers. They are presidents. They are the heads of the military. They run corporations. They're the head of all the Marxist states. Stalin, Mao, Obama, George W. These are all psychopaths. And they're never going to ever do what we want because they can't do what we want. They can only do what they want or what they're being told. And so my conclusion is that the people that run this world, in my view, they're archons. But if that offends you, then we'll just agree that they're psychopaths. And if we're all cool on that, then we now know that we're dealing with a bunch of people who are psychopaths at the very least, off-planet spiritual parasites at the very most, and that we now can identify them, and once ID'd, we can begin getting rid of them. I don't mean killing them. I mean getting them out of society so they can no longer have their input and their fingers in everything like they have now.
Right. Hey, I mean, it is off-putting for a lot of people, but I'm with you. I think there's something very strange going on at the top that is more than just greedy people concentrating their power and wealth.
Well, it is. I agree, and here's why. Because I know a lot of wealthy people, and wealthy people destroy their families. The wealth destroys their families. It may not be the first generation that gets destroyed, but by the second generation after the wealth, the families are drug addicts, sex addicts, alcoholics, divorce, you know, all sorts of perversions and everything. That is how it goes when you have a lot of money. What's interesting about the elites that we're talking about is it's transgenerational. It does not fall apart. It doesn't degenerate. The plan stays the plan. Everything stays on cue, no matter if it was 100 years ago when they did the Federal Reserve, or it's today and they're doing their false flags. We continuously see the same plan being executed, supposedly by generations of people And to me, that is absolutely impossible. Human beings are just too much of a screw-up to ever be able to carry out a hundreds of years long plan and execute it perfectly without anybody getting their ego involved. Yet, it is being done. And so I have chosen that this 2,000-year-old writings in the Nag Hammadi about the Archons are the closest to what I perceive as to being the truth of anything else that I've seen.
Yeah, the Nag Hammadi, that is the document that I had heard so much about. It was. Can you tell us about how that was found? It was found in clay jars or something like that?
Yeah, in Egypt in 1945, right when the Illuminati had won. Essentially, the Illuminati had won their war. They had won everything. They were setting up their national security state. They were setting up the CIA. They were setting up the United Nations. They were setting everything up. Exactly at that time, a little boy followed his goat into a cave on a hillside in Egypt and discovered these clay jars. Now, what's interesting about these clay jars is they have writings, scrolls in them, and in these scrolls were writings, and the writing had never been censored by popes or kings or politicians, and so we could actually get a sense of what people 2,000 years ago thought of the world without anybody in the in-between times interfering, like Constantine or the popes.
Right.
And so we finally got a translation of what people in the old days really thought, and it completely at variance to all the other writings. Now, here's the thing. Widener's first law says that those ideas which are the most suppressed are most likely the closest to the truth. So as soon as I found out about the Nag Hammadi, like 15, 20 years ago, and started reading them assiduously, I began wondering, well, who were these people that wrote all this stuff? Who were these Gnostics? And I'd taken, you know, religious courses in college, comparative religion courses and things, and I didn't know what a Gnostic was. And that pissed me off a little bit because I thought I was a pretty intelligent guy. I'd never heard of these people. So then I began looking, and lo and behold, I discovered that not only were they a huge religion 2,000 years ago, but that they had been systematically wiped off the face of the earth. And not just the people had been wiped off the face of the earth. Everything they wrote had been burned. And that is the reason why they burned the library at Alexandria, because it was a Gnostic residue of all that they thought about the world. And the Christians burned down the library, raped Hypatia in the middle of the streets of Alexandria, and we went into the Dark Ages. And they want us in the Dark Ages. They want us stupid. They don't want us figuring out anything.
Man, it is so refreshing to hear you say this, because even in high school, I can remember hearing about the, you know, European expansion and the destruction of any culture they came across. And I always thought that was so suspicious. It's like your first law says, you know, I think it's a clue to the truth to put so much energy into this slash and burn campaign and destroying all knowledge. Like, you know, they went everywhere on the planet to destroy any hint of old knowledge and then covered it up. So this Nag Hammadi text, I mean, finding these things is pretty incredible. And is this where they talk about the Archons? Is this what do they say? What's the storyline that they give out?
Well, they say that they have their creation story is a very interesting creation story. They say that there's these beings called Aeons who reside near the center of the galaxy, and that one of these Aeons, whose name was Sophia, she decided that she was going to imbue matter, the third dimension, with spirit, with a higher dimensional source, to see if she could do it. And the other Aeons were kind of transfixed by this whole idea, and they watched as Sophia went out to the edge of the galaxy to a little rocky world and made life. And but when she made the life, when she created the Earth, she created this place, and it was just so chaotic. that nature was so entangled that we couldn't, it was just beyond any hope as to there being any hope for consciousness, because there was so much entangled confusion within nature itself.
Mm-hmm.
But when she created Earth, the life on Earth, she also created archons. It was an accident. And the archons came to Earth, and they thought of themselves as kind of like a correction. And so they decided that they were going to correct Sophia's confused, entangled natural world, and they were going to bring in some order, i.e. rulers, to this process. And they began kind of coming in to us and forcing us into agriculture off of a meat and vegetable diet into a grain diet, which weakened us. They created the religions, especially the three Western religions. They were all designed to enslave us. Mm-hmm. And it's actually an anti-Earth movement, an anti-nature movement, the Archons are. They don't like nature. They don't like human beings too much. They don't like the fact that we can love each other unconditionally. They don't like the fact that we have souls and they do not. And so they want to control us. They want to prove to themselves that they are better than us and that we're a bunch of fools, and that if they just deny us knowledge and kill the people that are smart so that they can't pass knowledge on, that they will control the human race and then kind of harvest their souls. They believe that that they can take our essence from us. And maybe they can, I don't know, since I'm not an Archon. And so they create wars and all these things that are extremely anti-natural. So everything that they do is unnatural. They make straight lines instead of curved lines. They created L.A., for instance. No offense. L.A. is a great place, but I mean, L.A. is the king of archonic, the way that the Archons would build a city. They love sprawl. They love horror movies and violence and perversions. And right now they're on a full-scale effort to apparently pervert all of humanity so that we fall further and further away from our true source, which is immortal and all-knowing and possible, psychic abilities and things, into basically animals. And that's their goal.
Hey, Jay, I got a pretty simplistic question, but I'll throw it at you. So what's the first step in overthrowing the Archons for us non-Archons?
First step is to first identify them. We have to start identifying the Archons via the Internet. My friend Thomas Sheridan, who's a writer on psychopaths, says that we should create like a Lord of the Rings map showing you where Mordor is and stay away from Mordor, right? And then we have to realize that the culture that they have created, if you want to call it a culture, is a nightmare. And it's not a culture at all. It's just a rigged economic system. And we need to create a parallel culture, a parallel economy, away from the archontic culture and economy. And not really go head-to-head with them, because Archons, when you go head-to-head with them, they drop nukes on you and stuff. They have no empathy, so they'll kill everybody around you too to get to you. So it's foolish to go up against them head to head. So we have to identify them with us. Say, oh, he's an Archon. We better stay away from him completely, because you cannot convert an Archon. You cannot save a psychopath. They're beyond saving. Don't even bother saving or trying to convert one. As soon as you realize that you're dealing with a psychopath, you need to get away fast. And that is what we have to do with them. We need to get away from the culture they've created. We need to create small enclaves of like-minded people who are growing their own food and living their own culture, and create something that is so attractive that the archonic culture will just dissipate on its own. And right now we're losing the battle because the archons are feeding us pharmaceuticals. They're feeding us sex daily on TV at night, and violence, and the full bore assault on humanity has started. We are now in the spiritual war. It used to be that it was coming, but it's here now. And the reason it's here now is because we're identifying them and naming them. And that is not what they expected. And I'm really happy to say that even David Icke is now coming on board and identifying the archons. So we get a voice like David Icke to get in there and help. That could really throw it over for us. So I think the archons are actually beginning to get cornered. And if you've ever had a dog, an angry dog, cornered, you know how really vicious that experience can be. So it's a dangerous time. But at the same time, archons don't know how to deal with courage. And so when people stand up to them, you get fallacious arguments. They won't debate you. I guarantee it. You will not get an archon to debate you. They will avoid debate at all costs because they can't debate. They cannot exchange intellectual ideas because they're just shells of beings. They're not real.
I wish I was pulled over by more archon police officers because they seem to be very willing to debate me, unfortunately. Well, there's so many students of their philosophy, whether we're talking about literal archons or not. They've definitely created a system where we are students of their philosophy to a T. Their values,
yep.
if you want to call them values of any kind, are put in the forefront. I mean, that's definite. But you were talking. You mentioned David Icke. Is he drawing a distinction between reptilians and archons, or is he changing his view? Or are you talking about different entities?
I'm not going to speak for David because I can't tell you that. But I will say this. According to Nag Hammadi, the archons can create almost fictions in all directions. So you don't know what you're looking at. So they could be reptilian. They are described as reptilian in the Nag Hammadi. So, but once you understand that the archons create things out of thin air, then you have to kind of step way back and go, wait a minute. Everything I'm looking at is false. And then from that premise, you can go forth and then figure out reality. Once you say to yourself that, hey, I'm touching this, but is it real? And then finding a way to understand what is real, and what is just an archonic influence is really the trick. And I think that's the goal for all of us over, say, the next 5 or 10 years as this drama ensues. I think we're going to start identifying them on the internet. We're going to start identifying everything about them. And I think for the next few years, we're going to learn more and more and more. And they even now know that they're being identified. They're putting out movies like Seven Psychopaths to show that they're actually cute and cuddly and funny, and they're doing this all over the place. There's even a book out now about how being a psychopath can help you in the business world. You know, I mean, they're like really kind of coming out of the closet right now, and we can't let them get away with this.
Man, I mean, well, let's talk about the real reality. I mean, if we're covered in all their veiled realities, these false paradigms, these false values. What do you think are some of the biggest secrets that have been lost today that they've covered up?
Oh, that we are, they not only covered it up, they forced us into disusing our psychic abilities. The Catholic Church went through Europe and killed everybody who had psychic abilities, everybody that they found. If you were even whispered that you had some kind of unusual power, you were taken in front of the Inquisition and killed. Therefore, a whole swath of people with certain talents were removed from, and their progeny were removed. So that's one of the things. The other thing is that they made us aware of our racial differences so that we now judge each other on our skin color, whereas before the Archons, we didn't even care. And you can go look at, go to the Metropolitan Museum in New York or go to London, the British Museum, and look at paintings and engravings from ancient Egypt from 2000 BC, and you'll see that all the races are being pictured in the cities, in the streets and stuff. There was no racism. This is foisted on us, like a hatred of each other because of religions. This is all an Archon trick, believing there's a Messiah that's going to come save you,
yes.
Whether it's the aliens or Obama or Jesus.
That's a
is
big
another
one.
Trick. That's a huge one. That's one of their biggest ones. The Archons are always beating you up, a nasty beating you up, kicking your guts and stomping on your face. And then when they get done doing it and you look up and you say, "Why did you do that?" They look at you and they say, "I did it because I love you." That's the Archons. That's their idea of what love is. Is to knock the living snot out of you constantly and telling you that they're doing it because it's good for you. And that's an Archon trick. And this thing is, it's like endemic, and it can be caught and spread. So a child is abused by his dad, and then he becomes abuser of his children, who then begins abusing his children. And so the Archon interface is a generational and continuous, and it's contagious.
Yeah, man, that savior motif, that's a bad one. I mean, I know you've worked with David Wilcock. I mean, he's made me hopeful in the past with ideas of covert wars playing out, where we have some good Illuminati that are on the cusp of a real overthrow, and we're all going to get $10 million and everything will be revealed. And as much as I love those ideas, I just think I'm too cynical to believe that that's going to happen.
Yeah, actually, I've been having a lot of talks with David lately, and I think even he's starting to realize that there is a rogue group that is fighting against the Illuminati that's in our insiders. I have no doubt about that. But I'm not convinced that that rogue group is anywhere on our side. I think they're fighting for themselves.
That makes sense.
You know, do I want them to fight each other? Oh, yeah, fight each other to the death. Kill each other, guys. Do it. You know, no collateral damage. Just kill each other. I'd be for that, like, no tomorrow. But unfortunately, this thing is more complicated than we could ever dream, and we're in the end game right now. It's really kind of amazing to watch.
Well, another area that is super fascinating to me is, and I know you've worked with Richard Hoagland on this stuff, but he's got some really interesting research on space and our solar system, and I've yet to have him come on the show, but what is your take on the solar system? Because it seems to be that there's a lot of the big lies that the Archons have told us revolve around the solar system, the moon, Mars, even Saturn.
Oh, yeah, and the sun. A week ago, a third of the sun went missing. I don't know if you know that.
I did see that the other day. That's recent, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the sun is not what we think it is. The sun is not a big, huge ball of nuclear fission. The sun is actually hollow, and it has an outer edge, which is plasma, which is what we're seeing. And every time there's a sunspot, you're looking into the hollow sun. It's really the electric Earth, the electric universe. And these ideas will come forth as the years come out, too. Because the last thing the Archons want you to figure out is that you're actually electricity more than anything else. That the world, the Earth, the
yes.
solar system, the galaxy is run by electricity, not by proteins or all these other things. And when we figure that out, then we're going to realize that actually it's your health is governed by this, too. And there's a Dr. Robert O. Young, who is writing books about how to electrify yourself. This guy's proof positive that he's onto the right thing, because he's 62 years old and looks like he's about 40 or maybe 35. And his wife is 61 and she looks like she's about 30. And again, these are all discoveries that are coming out right now. There's the revolution that's occurring on the internet is a revolution against the Archons. We just don't know it yet. But we will, as time goes on, we'll realize that We don't need their medical system. We don't need their legal system. We don't need their economy. We don't need their crappy food. We certainly don't need their wars or their lies. And, you know, so it's going to start out with just a few people realizing this, creating parallel cultures, probably via the internet, and then we're going to end up being healthy and alive, and the people that don't believe in any of this stuff are going to be fat and unhealthy, and they're going to die. And that's like, unless the Archons just start killing everybody ad hoc, that's where this is going to end. And it's going to be, you know, 15 or 20 years before this happens. But the entire human race is wisening up all at the same time. That's never happened before in human history. All the smartest people on Earth are all reaching the same conclusions about reality all at the same time, right now. And, you know, the leading edge ones are looking at the Archons, or the ones that aren't as leading edge are looking at, say, just the Illuminati or corruption, that kind of thing. But eventually, every inquiring mind is going to ask themselves, you know, questions like, how the hell are the elites so smart that they can pull this off? And and though, once you start going down that road, that's when you get into the dangerous areas of Archons and psychopaths and off-planet intelligences and even demonic things. You know, Stanley Kubrick, I believe, he approached the Archon question in three different films. The first one was 2001, in which he posited that they were off-planet intelligences. The second movie where he talks about the Archons is in The Shining, when he says that there are demonic influences that can get inside your head and turn you into, you know, someone who wants to kill your family. The third movie talking about the Archons is Eyes Wide Shut, in which he's now positing that the ruling elite are these Archons. And I say it's all three. I say it's off-planet intelligences who also appear to look like demonic influences, who are also our ruling elites. So it's all three.
It is an all-encompassing thing. It's a lot to take in. But I want to touch on, you mentioned electricity, that we are electricity. And I think this gets into the idea of true human potential, which is deep, deep down that rabbit hole, the light body, stuff like that. Because on the deeper levels of diet and vaccines and chemtrails and HARP and fluoride and all that stuff, that affects our biology, it seems like the simple explanation is, well, if they're all sick and tired all the time, it makes it hard for them to rebel and will remain weak and docile, which is true. But on a deeper level, it seems like the Archons or the true elites are hitting us with all these chemicals as if they're beating back a powerful force deep within the individual. I mean, is that kind of where you come from?
Yeah, that's it. We are already fully realized. We just don't know it. We're fully realized. We are already extremely powerful beings. I don't know if you've ever studied Taoism, but you know, there's a movie on YouTube. It was taken by these two brothers who went to Indonesia in the 70s with their 16-millimeter camera to show, you know, what people were like, these spirit psychics and spiritual people. And they've got a Taoist master who, you know, literally puts his hand over a piece of paper and lights it on fire.
Really?
Right? From 3 feet away. Yeah, on film. And so we have these abilities. It's just that these Archons know that if they let those abilities atrophy, they're safe. But if we don't let those abilities atrophy, if we find ways to bring our powerful beings to their full fruition, the Archons are finished, and they know it, and they're so frightened of that. They're so frightened of a great awakening, a spiritual liberation. And we have to, all of us, everybody listening, are all the soldiers in this rebellion. We're all frontline soldiers, and we have to have courage. We have to stand up, and we have to realize that we are so much more powerful than we've been led to believe. Take the archonic invention of evolution. Well, what is evolution saying? Evolution is saying, and I'm not going to argue about the science, evolution is saying that there's something in the future we're headed towards. And someday, you know, if we treat ourselves right and we do everything right, the human species is going to evolve. magically evolve into something better. Well, that's exactly the opposite of the truth. The truth is that we're already there. They've made us asleep. We need to wake up. And once you wake up, you realize how really powerful you are, and that is the one thing that they cannot ever let happen.
Hey, Jay, you mentioned a shamanic experience. Could you talk a little bit more about that and the importance of shamanic experiences and how these can help us break free of the archons or the matrix?
Yeah, so, you know, you can have a shamanic experience. You know, you can go to the jungle and you can take ayahuasca or you can drum. There's many ways to have a shamanic experience. But what is the point of a shamanic experience? The point is to shatter your paradigm, to make you realize all the things that you thought aren't really true. And that means that you've got to go back to school and start doing your homework. Okay? So I have minor shamanic experiences all the time. For instance, I will go to the library or a bookstore and I will buy a book on a subject that is exactly the opposite of what I believe. I will make sure that I buy a book and read the book that's exactly the opposite of my belief system. Why do I do that? It's to shatter my belief system. If I start reading a book saying fundamentalist Christianity and I start finding myself agreeing with 40 or 50% of what I'm reading and I'm totally horrified that I'm agreeing with it, what is that doing to my head? Well, I'm presenting new ideas into my head that I never considered before, and that's causing me to rethink my previous positions. That's what shamanism does. It causes you to rethink the positions that you held previously. So I was a journalist. I believed in science. I was an atheist. And I had a shamanic experience which literally shattered me into a million pieces. And it took me years to regroup. And when I regrouped, I was a completely different person. I didn't believe any of the things that I'd believed before. And now, of course, I realize I was just archon influences from from the colleges and teachers and the churches and all the other things that were part of my life. And so that's why it's really important, I think, for everyone to have a shamanic experience. My old friend Terence McKenna used to say that not having a shamanic experience is like going through your entire life without having sex. I mean, it's like you can't describe what it's like to anybody if they haven't had it. Completely impossible to describe sex to a eunuch. So, you know, I encourage everyone to find their own path and to, as Daniel Pinchbeck says, you know, break open the head. You know, smash your head, not literally, just smash your psyche into a million pieces and regroup. I know it's a pain in the ass, but you'll be better off for it.
Amen, man. And let me ask you one more thing about the light body, because I'm really into the control mechanisms and all these things, and then it always goes into a sort of a new agey territory with the light body and meditation. Yep. And true reality. And this is where I'm having a disconnect, at least in my personal life, because I've gone to a Reiki master with no real effect, and I worry that this is another version of the savior motif, that it's all internal. And explain to me why it isn't, and what can someone do to really try to find some validation of this in their own life?
Well, that's a great question. There is a way that you can do this and validate it for yourself. So I'll do it like this. So forget all the light body and meditation stuff. You can go to that later. Let's try it this way.
Okay.
You, Adam, everybody listening right now, we are all in a dream. We are in a dream, and we're dreaming. And we're not in control of our dream. The difference between dreaming and lucid dreaming is that in a lucid dream, you're in control of your dream.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We are, none of us, well, maybe some of us, but most of us are just dreaming our dream and not lucidly dreaming our dream. Okay? So let's just say that that's true. Let's say that this is a dream. Okay? Now, I'm telling you that you can wake up in your dream. You can begin controlling your dream, lucidly controlling it. So I had a very, 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 very advanced person tell me this 20 years ago. And I said, well, you know, that's all great and everything, and yeah, you're successful and all that. But, I mean, how do I prove it? He says, just pick one thing. Just pick one thing. Make sure it isn't greedy. Don't wish for money, because that's a sure way to have this not succeed. Just do something like you want your little brother to be more successful, or you want to make sure he doesn't go to prison, or you want your sister to find a man and get married, something like that. And just start working on it, and you will see, because this is testable, that you are in control of your dream. Now, it's not going to happen right away. It'll take a few months, maybe even a year, for you to gain control of your dream, but it is entirely and absolutely possible. And I am living proof of it. And I'm not the only one. I've since passed this information on to many other people who began lucidly living their life. And when they did, they became in control of their life, and by gaining control of their life, they lost their uncertainty, they gained confidence. This led them even into larger amounts of control of their life, and until they become spiritually aware. And then the meditation, the light body, and all the rest of it begins to finally make sense. Because what are you doing when you're meditating? You're pulling yourself out of the life stream. And you're going inwards. You're beginning to get the discipline necessary to begin controlling your life, to living a lucid life. And in the end, we finally get to the point where we realize that it's possible for the human mind to even make the human body immortal. I know this sounds all really wild and crazy, but it's all true, and it's based in fact, and you can do it yourself. So start living the life that you want to live, not the life they want you to live. And then you'll find, as you live the life that you want to live, that everything you want comes to fruition.
I mean, that sounds great. I know there are a lot of people out there that are shackled to work, working jobs they don't care about. They listen to shows like this often during that job. And
quit your job. If you aren't doing what you like, quit.
That's so funny. I actually, I do a conspiracy t-shirt brand as well, and one of the shirts is a homeless guy holding up a sign, and his sign says, quit your job. And I love the symbolism of that. Instead of asking for something, he's saying, no, you are the one who needs help.
Exactly. You're not going to die. They're not going to kill you. There's nothing to be afraid of. That's the thing, is that our kinds have built us into a prison of fear, so we don't want to go live our own life.
And there is something to say, a lot of Zen philosophers talk about living in the present moment, and anytime you get really fearful or anytime you get really stressed out, it's because you're concentrating on a perceived future that you can't really control. But, you know, you say, I can't quit today because rent's due in 30 days. Well, maybe something's going to happen in that 30 days, but it is quite scary.
It will happen. If you embrace it with all the courage you can muster, your rent will get paid.
That's the leap. I'm right at the edge there, and I want to make that leap, and I want to believe that to be true. But I just am not sure. It is funny, because a little anecdote about this is, the other day I was in a really negative headspace, and my girlfriend's a little more on the side of this kind of stuff, and I said, you know, the last piece of the puzzle is me getting a ticket. And on my way home from work, I actually made eye contact with a cop. I made eye contact with him, and in that moment I said, he's getting me. I know he's fucking getting me. And he got in his car, pulled me over, and made me get out of the car and sit on my hands, if that's not symbolic enough. And she's like, you manifested that. And I was like, well, why can't I just fucking manifest some good things? You know, it's always the negative thoughts that seem to come to fruition.
Yeah.
You've answered it yourself. You answered it yourself.
I need more positive thoughts. I guess that's what we're getting at.
Yeah. It's really courage. It's like, you just have to, you know, when I get pulled over by a cop, I just say, you know, this is going to be the most awesome ticket I've ever got. And then I talk to the cop like he's a real human being, and all of a sudden, sometimes I don't even get a ticket because I address them as people, and they are so appreciative of that, because usually everybody's afraid of them.
Yeah, and they feed on that just as much.
They do, exactly. That's the key to understanding what the Archons, it's a contagion, and so the cops themselves. But they don't really want to be that way. Nobody really wants to be an Archon but the Archons.
Yeah, it's crazy, man, but it's been great talking to you. But I mean, Adam, is there anything you wanted to add before it looks like we're getting to an hour? Is there anything you wanted to throw out there?
Oh, we could keep going and going, but yeah, it's been a great hour talking to you, Jay.
Yeah, it's been great.
Well, do you have anything, Jay, that you're working on? You want to tell people about your website, some of your projects, what you got going on?
Yeah, if you really want to wake up, I am now the programming director at an online television streaming network like Netflix, only it's for people like us. It's called GaiamTV, GAIAMTV, .com. And if you want to help me, then you hit /Weidner, WEIDNER. And go there and join it for 10 days. David Wilcox on there. I'm going to be doing a show with Richard Hoagland. George Norrie's on there. Daniel Pinchbeck's going to have a show soon. We're really trying to bust the paradigm loose as fast as we can. So that's the best way that you can do it, especially if you've got skeptical family and friends. Get them a subscription to it. And, you know, I found that after a little while of watching this stuff, they begin changing.
Yeah, skip the mall and get him a subscription to GaiamTV.
That's right.
Excellent, man. Well, thanks again. You know, it has been a fascinating show. Hope we can do it again sometime because there's just so much more to talk about.
Yeah.
And
sounds good.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too, man. All right. Talk to you guys later.
Okay.
Take care, Jay.
Wow, man. Far out stuff. How'd you feel about that one?
Oh, that was cool. Enjoyed that quite a bit. I was somewhat familiar with his work, but this gave me a broader perspective. I was just familiar with the Kubrick material, but yeah, he has some interesting ideas.
The Kubrick branch on the conspiracy tree is one that I definitely love because I like to. It's again the synchronicity thing, of developing a true view of the universe. But I loved Kubrick as a kid, and I used to want to be a film director. So I do think there's a part of me that like really likes the Kubrick tie-in with the conspiracy because I'm like, oh, it's all synchronistic in my life because I was interested in Kubrick when I was 11 years old, and here we are still talking about him at 27. But, you know, Jay points out a lot of information that's just really solid.
Yeah, I agree. It's fun talking to him.
Let me ask you how you feel about the Enlightenment. Do you think people are waking up? Do you see it happening?
I don't know. I don't know.
It's tough. It is tough to say. Yeah. I mean, I was literally thinking about this yesterday, trying to determine where on the scale of awakening I think we are, because, you know, there are some positives, but there are some huge negatives. And I'm going into the bank, which is probably the worst place for me to be thinking about this stuff.
It seems like we're more enslaved in a lot of ways, you know. With
agreed.
Everything with the, well, yeah, this is the big matrix, the banking, the social media has evolved into, all the snooping that goes on.
Right, it's infiltrated just as much.
What the media is, what's on television. I mean, whether you believe that the Archons are from another planet or whatever, there's that negative influence in society, which I think we can find different ways to break free of, you know, on a lot of levels. And,
yeah.
just personal, what you eat each day, what you consume.
Yes.
How you spend your time, you know?
Yeah, the food thing's really interesting to me because, you know, we were talking to that guy, Wheat Belly, and and Jay was talking about, you know, wheat being a bad thing. I'm hearing this more and more
that
wheat's bad for you. And in fact, one interesting thing I heard recently talking about religions being there for control mechanisms is that fatty acids are good for your brain, and that is why all religions have days where you don't eat meat or they have things against eating meat. And
well, I got into
how
that.
How funny is that?
Yeah, there's a lot to that Wheat Belly thing. I got into that, and I've changed my diet over the years. And the thing with the wheat, it got hybridized back in the 80s, and it, basically what's put forth in the book, when you consume the wheat, we don't have the original wheat that dates back thousands of years. It's this new hybridized, which really happened in the 80s or so, which, according to the thesis of the guy who wrote the Wheat Belly book, is responsible for obesity and bad health and all of this. And, you know, if you look at some of the data, when you consume wheat, your body produces a lot more sugar than, you know, consuming straight sugar. Mm-hmm. And it creates this vicious cycle where you consume more of wheat and these type of things, high fructose in your diet and all this, these nasty additives and that. So what is put forward in the book is more of a paleo type natural diet, eating fruits and vegetables and meat, you know, trying to find meat that doesn't have a lot of stuff pumped into it as well, you know. The
That's a challenge.
Grass fit. It's not necessarily that difficult. It just takes time preparing. Part of it's preparing your own meals each day, you know, and we're all, a lot of people are strapped for time, you know, with just living life.
If it's not time, it's cash.
I hear you mention sometimes McDonald's and these type of things. Definitely get the hell away from fast food. It, there's some nasty stuff in that, and it's a vicious cycle. There's not a whole lot of good you can find from a fast food restaurant.
Yeah, I mean that. Well, that's what I was saying. I think you're referencing my Facebook from the other day where I said I managed to resist McDonald's during the Monopoly game, which is really tough for me because they're hitting two of my addictions at one time, with gambling and bad junk food.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can stay away then, I mean that's the real empowerment of the human spirit, I guess. The true triumph of the will.
Yeah.
But I mean, I would love to believe that we're waking up, but some days, like I went into that bank and I go up to the teller and I say, you know, how you doing, man? He's like, oh, you know, I'm great, but I've really had to use the bathroom for the past hour and just haven't been able to go. I go, I'm a grown man, not being able to take a piss does not sound great to me. And he just stares at me because, well, I mean, what can you do? He's at work. But I'm like, I feel like some people are getting closer to robotic, automated beings with a plastered smile on their face, and they're empty inside. And that offends me. That bothers me.
Well, it starts with you, you know.
Right.
Personally, break free. Then you can worry about others.
That is the challenge. And I think I'm about 60 days away from quitting that corporate job, but you know, that's a scary thing, but I guess you got to go at it with positivity and confidence and tell those archons to fuck off.
There you go.
All right, man. Well, on that note, you know, I love having you on. Thanks for your contributions to THD through your blog Transmissions from a Dying Planet. Always nice to throw something extra out to the people during the week. I do love that you do that.
Right on. This was a good one.
Yeah, this was. So keep rocking towards the free world, and we'll see you again, man. We'll talk. We'll do another interview next month.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, man. Peace.
Take care.